known group of such victims anywhere in the world. Van Bommel and Rosie presented their research at the 1986 American Psychological Association annual meeting in Washington, D.C. The audience was riveted. The women in this study became blind or nearly blind, not because of some eye disease or physical malfunction, but because the events they lived through had such an emotional impact that they literally cried until they could not see. The heightened emotional amplitude from being forced to bear witness to the unbearable left them not wanting to see anymore. The event created physical changes in their biology, not in their eyes, but most likely in their brains, which altered their perception of reality for the rest of their lives. And because they kept replaying the traumatizing scenes over and over in their minds, their vision never improved. While this is certainly an extreme example, our past traumatic experiences probably have similar effects on us. If you're having vision challenges, what things might you have chosen not to see because of painful or frightening past experiences? Similarly, if you're having hearing challenges, what in your life might you be unwilling to hear? Figure 7.2 charts how all of this happens. The line in the chart reflects a relative measurement of a person's state of being, which starts out at a more or less normal or baseline level before the event occurs. When the line spikes, it indicates a strong emotional reaction to an event, such as when the women experienced the atrocities of the Khmer Rouge soldiers. That horrific experience neurologically branded their brains and chemically changed their bodies, as well as altered their state of being, their thoughts, their feelings, their attitudes, their beliefs, and ultimately their perceptions. Specifically, the women no longer wished to look at the world anymore. So through neurological rewiring and chemical resignaling, their biology complied. Although the line in the graph eventually falls and levels off, the place where it ends up is a different place from where it began, indicating that the person remains chemically and neurologically altered by the experience. At that point for the Cambodian women, they were effectively living in the past, because they remained affected by the neurological and chemical branding that had come from the experience. They were no longer the same women. The event changed their state of being. Just changing your beliefs and perceptions once isn't enough. You have to reinforce that change over and over. To see why, let's return for a moment to the Parkinson's patients mentioned earlier, who improved their motor skills after receiving a saline injection that they thought was a powerful drug. As you'll recall, the moment they moved into a state of better health, their autonomic nervous system started to endorse this new state by producing dopamine in their brains. That didn't happen because they were praying or hoping or wishing their bodies would make dopamine. It happened because they became people who made dopamine. Unfortunately, however, the effect doesn't stick for everyone. In fact, for some, the placebo effect only lasts for a certain amount of time, because they go back to who they were before, their old states of being. In this case, when the Parkinson's patients went back home and saw their caregivers, saw their spouses, slept in the same beds, ate the same food, sat in the same rooms, and maybe played chess with the same friends who complained about their pains, their same old environments reminded them of their same old personalities and their same old states of being. All of the conditions in their familiar lives reminded them of who they were before, so they just slipped right back into those identities, and their various motor problems recurred. They re-identified with their environments. The environment is that strong. The same thing happens with drug addicts who've been clean for many years. If you put them back in their same environments where they used to do drugs, even without their ingesting any drug, being there turns on the same receptor sites in their cells that the drugs did when they were using. And that in turn creates physiological changes in their bodies, as if they'd taken the drugs, increasing their cravings. Their conscious minds have no control over that. It's automatic. Let's examine this concept a bit further. You've learned that the conditioning process creates strong associative memories. You've also learned that associative memories stimulate subconscious, automatic, physiological functions by activating the autonomic nervous system. Think of Pavlov's dogs again. Once Pavlov conditioned the dogs to associate the bell with getting fed, the dogs' bodies were immediately physiologically changed, without much control from the conscious mind. It was the cue from the environment that, via associative memory, automatically, autonomically, subconsciously, and physiologically, changed the dogs' internal states. They began to salivate, and their digestive juices turned on, because they were anticipating a reward. The dog's conscious minds couldn't do that. It was the stimulus from the environment that created the associative memory, from the conditioned response. Now let's revisit the Parkinson's patients and the former drug users. We could say that the instant any one of these individuals returned to their familiar environment, the body would automatically and physiologically return back to the old state of being, without the conscious mind having much control over it. In fact, that past state of being, which has been thinking and feeling the same way for years on end, has conditioned the body to become the mind. That is, the body is the mind that responds to the environment. That's why it's so hard for anyone in this situation to change. And the greater the addiction to the emotion, the greater the conditioned response to the stimulus in the environment. For example, let's say you are addicted to coffee and wanted to break your addiction to it. If you were visiting my house, and I started making Java, and you heard the blast of the espresso machine, smelled the coffee brewing, and saw me drinking it, here's what would happen. The moment your senses picked up those cues from the environment, your body, as the mind, would subconsciously, automatically respond without much help from your conscious mind, because you conditioned it to be that way. Your body-mind would then be craving its physiological reward, waging a war against your conscious mind, trying to convince you to take a sip or two. But if you truly broke the addiction to coffee, and then I made a cup in front of you, you could have some, or not, because you wouldn't have the physiological response you had previously. You'd no longer be conditioned. Your body would no longer be the mind, and the associative memory of your environment would no longer have the same effect on you. The same holds true for emotional addictions. For instance, if you have memorized guilt from your past experiences and unconsciously live that way every day in the present, then like most people, you'll use someone or something at some place in your external environment to reaffirm your addiction to guilt. Try as you might to be consciously greater than it, the moment you see your mother, whom you used to feel guilty, at the house where you grew up, your body will autonomically, chemically, and physiologically return to the same past state of guilt in the present moment, without your conscious mind being involved. Your body, which has been subconsciously programmed to be the mind of guilt, is already living in the past in that present moment. So it's more natural to feel guilty when you're with your mother than to feel any other way. And just as in the drug addict, a conditioned response has altered your internal state based on your association with your present, past, external reality. Break the addiction to guilt by changing the subconscious programming, and you can be in the presence of the same conditions and remain free from your present, past reality. Researchers from the Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand examined the effect of environment using a group of 148 college students who were invited to take part in a study set in a bar-like atmosphere. The researchers told half the students that they would get vodka and tonic, and told the rest they'd receive just tonic water. In reality, the bartenders in the study didn't pour a single drop of vodka. All the students got just plain tonic. The bar-like atmosphere the researchers fashioned looked very realistic, right down to the resealing of the vodka bottles that had been cleverly filled with flat tonic water. The bartenders rimmed glasses with limes dunked in vodka for a more realistic effect, before proceeding to mix and pour drinks as though they were serving the real thing. The subjects became tipsy and acted drunk, with some even showing physical signs of intoxication. They didn't get drunk because they drank alcohol. They got drunk because the environment, by associative memory, cued their brains and bodies to respond in the same old, familiar way. When the researchers eventually told the students the truth, many were amazed and insisted that they really did feel drunk at the time. They believed they were drinking alcohol, and those beliefs translated into neurochemicals, which altered their states of being. In other words, their beliefs alone were sufficient to fire up a biochemical change in their bodies that was equal to being drunk. That's because the students conditioned themselves enough times to associate alcohol with a change in their internal chemical states. As the subjects expected or anticipated the future change in their inner states, based on their past associative memories of drinking, they were cued by the environment to physiologically change, just as did Pavlov's dogs. There's a flip side too, of course. The environment can also signal healing. Hospital patients in Pennsylvania who recovered from surgery in a room with a view of a stand of trees in a natural suburban setting needed less potent pain medications and were released 7 to 9 days earlier than patients in rooms facing a brown brick wall. Our states of mind, created from the environment, can most definitely contribute to healing our brains and our bodies. So then, do you need a sugar pill, or a saline injection, or a sham procedure, or a picture window? Something, or someone, or some place in your external environment to move into a new state of being? Or can you do it just by changing how you think and feel? Can you simply believe in a new possibility of health without relying on any external stimulus and make the thought in your brain a new emotional experience to the degree that it changes your body and you become greater than the conditioning in your external environment? If so, what you've just read suggests that it would be a good idea to change your internal state every day, before you get up and face your same old environment, so that it won't pull you, as it did the Parkinson's patients, back to your old state of being. Remember Janice Schoenfeld from Chapter 1, who made physical changes in her brain by thinking she was taking an antidepressant? Part of the reason the placebo worked so well for her was that taking that inert pill was a daily reminder to change her state of being, because she associated taking the pill with her optimistic thoughts and feelings about getting better, as do more than 80% of people who take an antidepressant placebo. If you could access a new state of being through meditation, by combining a clear intention with getting in touch with that heightened state of emotion that was mentioned earlier, and you got up jazzed and on fire about what you were creating every day, you'd finally start coming out of your resting state. You'd then be in a new state of being, with a different attitude, belief, and perception, no longer reacting to the same things in the same way, because now your environment would no longer control how you think and feel. You'd then be making new choices and demonstrating new behaviors, which would lead to new experiences and new emotions. And so you'd then turn into a new and different personality. A personality that doesn't have the arthritic pain, or the Parkinson's motor issues, or the infertility, or whatever other condition you want to change. I want to take a moment to point out here that not all sickness and disease starts in our minds, of course. Certainly babies are born with genetic defects and conditions that clearly couldn't have been triggered by their thoughts, feelings, attitudes and beliefs. And trauma and accidents do indeed happen. Furthermore, exposure to environmental toxins can definitely wreak havoc in the human body. My point is not that when these things come up, we've somehow asked for them. Although it's true that our physical bodies can be weakened by stress hormones and made more susceptible to disease when our immune systems shut down. My point is that no matter what the source of our ills, there's a possibility that we can change our condition. So now we can see that if we want to change our beliefs and create a placebo effect to improve our health and our lives, we have to do the exact opposite of what the Cambodian women did by default. By holding a clear and firm intention and heightening our emotional energy, we have to create a new internal experience in our minds and bodies that's greater than the past external experience. In other words, when we decide to create a new belief, the amplitude or energy of that choice must be high enough that it's greater than the hardwired programs and emotional conditioning in the body. To see what happens when we do just this, take a look at figure 7.3 on the following page. Here, the energy of the choice in this new experience is greater than the energy of the trauma in the past experience, as we saw in figure 7.2, which is why the peak in this graph is higher than the peak in the first graph. And as a result, the effects of this new experience override the residue of the neural programming and emotional conditioning from the past experience. This process, if we do it right, actually repatterns our brains and changes our biology. The new experience will reorganize the old programming, and in so doing, it will remove the neurological evidence of that past experience. Think of how a bigger wave breaking farther up on the beach erases any signs of whatever shell, seaweed, seafoam, or sand pattern was there before. Strong emotional experiences create long-term memories. So this new internal experience creates new long-term memories that override our past long-term memories. Thus, the choice becomes an experience that we never forget. There should be no evidence of our pasts in our brains and our bodies any longer. And the new signal then rewrites the neurological program and genetically changes the body. Now look at figure 7.3 again. And notice how the slope of the line in the graph goes all the way back down, whereas in figure 7.2, it descended but still remained higher than it was at the point where it started. That shows there's no trace left of the past experience. It no longer exists in this new state of being. In addition to reorganizing your neurocircuitry, this new signal also begins to rewrite the body's conditioning by breaking the emotional attachment to the past. When that happens, in that second, the body is living fully in the present. It is no longer a prisoner of the past. That heightened energy is felt within the body and translated as a new emotion, which is just another way of saying energy in motion or emotion. Whether that emotion is feeling invincible, courageous, empowered, compassionate, inspired, or whatever. And it's energy that's changing our biology, our neurocircuitry, and our genetic expression, not chemistry. A similar process happens with the firewalkers, the glass chewers, and the snake handlers. they get clear that they're going to move into a different state of mind and body. And when they hold that firm intention to make that shift, the energy of that decision creates internal changes in their brains and bodies that make them immune to the external conditions in the environment for an extended period of time. Their energy now is protecting them in a way that, in that moment, transcends their biology. As it happens, our neurochemistry isn't the only thing that responds to heightened states of energy. The receptor sites on the outside of the body's cells happen to be 100 times more sensitive to energy and frequency than they are to the physical chemical signals, like neuropeptides, that we know gain access to our cells' DNA. Research consistently reveals that invisible forces of the electromagnetic spectrum influence every single aspect of cellular biology and genetic regulation. Cell receptors are frequency-specific to incoming energy signals. The energies of the electromagnetic spectrum include microwaves, radio waves, X-rays, extremely low-frequency waves, sound harmonic frequencies, ultraviolet rays, and even infrared waves. Specific frequencies of electromagnetic energy can influence the behavior of DNA, RNA, and protein synthesis, alter protein shape and function, control gene regulation and expression, stimulate nerve cell growth and influence cell division and cell differentiation, as well as instruct specific cells to organize into tissues and organs. All of these cellular activities influenced by energy are part of the expression of life. And if that's true, then it has to be true for some reason. Remember the 98.5% of our DNA that scientists call junk DNA because it doesn't seem to serve much of a useful purpose. Surely Mother Nature wouldn't place all of this encoded information in our cells waiting to be read without giving us the ability to create some type of signal to unlock it. After all, nature doesn't waste anything. Could it be that your own energy and consciousness is what creates the right kind of signal outside of the cells to enable you to tap into that vast parts list of potentials? And if that was true, if you changed your energy the way you read about earlier in this chapter, could that help you access your true ability to authentically heal your body? When you change your energy, you change your state of being. And the rewiring in the brain and the new chemical emotions in the body trigger epigenetic changes. And the result is that you become quite literally a new person. The person you were before is history. A part of that person simply vanished along with the neurocircuitry, chemical emotional addictions, and genetic expression that supported your old state of being. Chapter 8. The Quantum Mind. Reality can be a bit of a moving target, literally. We're used to thinking of reality as something fixed and certain, but as you'll soon see in this chapter, the way we've always been taught to see it isn't the way it really is. And if you're going to learn how to be your own placebo by using your mind to affect matter, it's vital that you understand the true nature of reality, how mind and matter are related, and how reality can shift. Because if you don't know how and why those shifts occur, you won't be able to direct any outcomes according to your intentions. Before we dive into the quantum universe, let's take a look at where our ideas about reality came from, and where they've brought us so far. Thanks to René Descartes and Sir Isaac Newton, for centuries the study of the universe was divided into two categories, matter and mind. The study of matter, the material world, was declared the realm of science because, for the most part, the laws of the universe that govern the object's outer world could be calculated and therefore predicted. But the inner realm of the mind was considered too unpredictable and complicated. So it was therefore left to the auspices of religion. Over time, matter and mind became separate entities, and dualism was born. Newtonian physics, also known as classical physics, deals with the mechanics of how objects function in space and time, including their interactions with each other in the material, physical world. Because of Newton's laws, we can measure and predict what path planets take around the sun, how quickly an apple accelerates when it falls from a tree, and how long it takes to go from Seattle to New York by plane. Newtonian physics is about the predictable. It looks at the universe as if it functioned like an enormous machine or a huge timepiece. But classical physics has its limitations when it comes to the study of energy, the actions of the immaterial world beyond space and time, and the behavior of atoms, the building blocks of everything in the physical universe. That realm belongs to quantum physics. And it turns out that this very tiny subatomic world of electrons and photons doesn't behave anything like the much larger world of planets, apples and aeroplanes that we're more familiar with. When quantum physicists began to look at the smaller and smaller aspects of an atom, like what makes up the nucleus, the closer they looked, the less distinct and clear the atom became, until eventually it just completely disappeared. Atoms, they tell us, appear to be 99.999999999999% empty space. But that space isn't really empty. It's actually filled with energy. More specifically, it's made up of a vast array of energy frequencies that form a kind of invisible, interconnected field of information. So if every atom is 99.999999999999% energy or information, that means that our known universe and everything in it, no matter how solid that matter may appear to us, is essentially just energy and information. That's a scientific fact. Atoms do contain a smattering of matter, but when the quantum physicists tried to study it, they discovered something really strange. Subatomic matter in the quantum world doesn't behave anything at all like the matter we're used to dealing with. Instead of adhering to the laws of Newtonian physics, it appears somewhat chaotic and unpredictable, completely disregarding the boundaries of time and space. In fact, on the subatomic quantum level, matter is a momentary phenomenon. It's here one moment, and then it disappears. It exists only as a tendency, a probability, or a possibility. In the quantum, there are no absolute physical things. That wasn't the only strange discovery that scientists made about the quantum universe. They also found that when they observed particles of subatomic matter, they could affect or change their behavior. The reason they're here and gone, and then here and gone again all the time, is that all of these particles actually exist simultaneously in an infinite array of possibilities, or probabilities, within the invisible and infinite quantum field of energy. It's only when an observer focuses attention on any one location of any one electron that the electron actually appears in that place. Look away, and the subatomic matter disappears back into energy. So according to this observer effect, physical matter can't exist or manifest until we observe it, until we notice it and give it our attention. And when we're no longer paying attention to it, it vanishes, going back from whence it came. So matter is constantly transforming, oscillating between manifesting into matter and disappearing into energy. About 7.8 times per second, as a matter of fact. And so because the human mind, as the observer, is then intimately connected to the behavior and appearance of matter, you could say that mind over matter is a quantum reality. Another way to look at it is this. In the tiny world of the quantum, the subjective mind has an effect on objective reality. Your mind can become matter. That is, you can make your mind matter. Since subatomic matter makes up everything we can see and touch and experience in our macro world, then in a sense we, along with everything in our world, are also doing this disappearing and reappearing act all the time. And so if subatomic particles exist in an infinite number of possible places simultaneously, then in some way, so do we. And just as these particles go from existing everywhere simultaneously, wave or energy, to existing precisely where the observer looks for them at that moment, the observer is paying attention, particle or matter. We're also potentially capable of collapsing an infinite number of potential realities into physical existence. In other words, if you can imagine a particular future event that you want to experience in your life, that reality already exists as a possibility somewhere in the quantum field, beyond this space and time, just waiting for you to observe it. If your mind, through your thoughts and feelings, can affect when and where an electron appears out of nowhere, then theoretically, you should be able to influence the appearance of any number of possibilities that you can imagine. From a quantum perspective, if you observed yourself in a particular new future that was different from your past, expected that reality to occur, and then emotionally embraced the outcome, you'd be, for a moment, living in that future reality, and you'd be conditioning your body to believe it was in that future in the present moment. So the quantum model, which states that all possibilities exist in this moment, gives us permission to choose a new future and observe it into reality. And because the entire universe is made of atoms, with more than 99% of an atom being energy or possibility, that means that there's a lot of potential out there that you and I might be missing. However, this also means that you create by default as well. If you, as the quantum observer, look at your life from the same level of mind every day, then according to the quantum model of reality, you're causing infinite possibilities to collapse into the same patterns of information day in and day out. Those patterns, which you call your life, never change. So they never allow you to affect change. So the mental rehearsal I talked about earlier is certainly not idle daydreaming or wishful thinking. It is, in a very real sense, the way you can intentionally manifest your desired reality, including a life without pain or disease. By focusing more on what you do want, and less on what you don't want, you can call into existence whatever you desire and simultaneously fade away what you don't want by no longer giving it your attention. Where you place your attention is where you place your energy. Once you fix your attention on your awareness or your mind on possibility, you place your energy there as well. As a result, you're affecting matter with your attention or observation. The placebo effect is not fantasy then, it's quantum reality. All atoms in the elemental world emit various electromagnetic energies. For example, an atom can give off invisible fields of energy at different frequencies that include X-rays, gamma rays, ultraviolet rays, and infrared rays, as well as visible light rays. And just as invisible radio waves carry a frequency with specific information encoded into it, whether it's 98.6 or 107.5 Hz, each different frequency likewise carries specific diverse information, as shown in Figure 8.1. For example, X-rays carry very different information than infrared rays do, because they are different frequencies. All of these fields are different energy patterns that are always giving off information at the atomic level. Think of atoms as vibrating fields of energy, or small vortices that are constantly spinning. To better understand how that works, let's use the analogy of a fan. Just like a circular fan creates wind, a vortex of air, when it's turned on, each atom, as it spins, radiates a field of energy in a similar fashion. And just like a fan can spin at different speeds, and so create stronger or weaker wind, atoms also vibrate at different frequencies that create stronger or weaker fields. The faster the atom vibrates, the greater the energy and frequency it emits. The slower the speed of the atom's vibration or vortex, the less energy it creates. The slower a fan's blades spin, the less wind or energy is created, and the easier it is to see the blades as material objects in physical reality. On the other hand, the faster the blades spin, the more energy is created, and the less you see of the physical blades. The blades appear to be immaterial. Where the fan blades can potentially appear, like the subatomic particles the quantum scientists were trying to observe that kept popping in and out of view, depends on your observation, where and how you look for them. And so it is with atoms. Let's look at this in a little more depth. In quantum physics, matter is defined as a solid particle, and the immaterial energetic field of information can be defined as the wave. When we study the physical properties of atoms like mass, atoms look like physical matter. The slower the frequency that an atom is vibrating, the more time it spends in physical reality, and the more it appears as a particle that we can see as solid matter. The reason physical matter appears solid to us, even though it's mostly energy, is that all of the atoms are vibrating at the same speed we are. But atoms also display many properties of energy or waves, including light, wavelengths, and frequency. The faster an atom vibrates and the more energy it generates, the less time it spends in physical reality. It's appearing and disappearing too fast for us to see it, because it's vibrating at a much faster speed than we are. But even though we can't see the energy itself, we can sometimes see physical evidence of certain frequencies of energy, because the force field of atoms can create physical properties, such as the way infrared waves heat things up. If you compare Figure 8.2a to Figure 8.2b, you can see how slower frequencies spend more time in the material world and thus appear as matter. So the physical universe may look as if it's made up of only material matter, but in truth, it shares a field of information, the quantum field, that unifies matter and energy so intimately that it's impossible to consider them as separate entities. That's because all particles are connected in an immaterial, invisible field of information beyond space and time. And that field is made of consciousness, thought, and energy, frequency, the speed at which things vibrate. Because each atom has its own specific field of energy, or energy signature, when atoms assemble collectively to form molecules, they share their fields of information and then radiate their own unique combined energy patterns. If everything material in the universe radiates a specific unique energy signature because everything is made of atoms, then you and I radiate our own specific energy signatures as well. You and I are always broadcasting information as electromagnetic energy, based on our states of being. So when you change your energy to alter a belief or perception about yourself or your life, you're actually increasing the frequency of the atoms and molecules of your physical body so that you're amplifying your energy field, as shown in figure 8.3. You're turning up the speed of the atomic fans that make up your body. As you embrace a heightened emotional creative state like inspiration, empowerment, gratitude, or invincibility, you're causing your atoms to spin faster, just like the fan blades, and to broadcast a stronger energy field around your body, which affects your physical matter. So the physical particles that make up your body are now responding to an elevated energy. You're becoming more energy and less matter. You're now more wave and less particle. Using your consciousness, you're creating more energy so that matter can be lifted to a new frequency, and your body responds to a new mind. So how does matter become lifted to a new mind? Think of the preacher who moves into a state of religious ecstasy and drinks strychnine with no biological effects. How did he overcome that chemistry that would normally poison the average person? It was his level of energy that transcended the effects of matter. He made a decision with such firm intention that his choice carried an amplitude of energy that transcended the laws of the environment, the effects on the body, and linear time. In that moment, he was more energy and less matter. And as a result, it was a new energy that rewrote the circuitry in his brain, the chemistry in his body, and his genetic expression. In that present moment, he wasn't his identity that was connected to his familiar environment, nor was he his physical body, nor was he living in linear time. His elevated consciousness and energy were the epiphenomenon of matter. In other words, it's both information and frequency that give rise to the blueprints of matter. And when we're demonstrating an elevated level of awareness and energy, it's these elements that influence matter, because matter is created from a lowering of frequency and information. It's entirely possible that the preacher's cell receptor sites weren't selectively open for the strychnine. The cell's doors were closed to poison, and so were suspended from its effects. By being moved by the spirit, that is, moved by energy, he instantly upregulated the cells in his body for immunity and downregulated the cells in his body for poison. The same thing is at work with the firewalkers. Once they change their state of being, their cell receptors are no longer open to the effects of heat. This is also what allowed the teenage girls to lift the 3,000-pound tractor to free their father, as you read about in Chapter 1. When they saw their father trapped and almost certain to die, their heightened state of energy turned off the cell receptors that normally would tell their bodies that the tractor was too heavy to lift, and turned on the muscle cell receptors to bear a greater load, so that when they tried, their muscles responded and they were able to free their dad. It wasn't matter, body, that was moving matter, tractor. It was energy that was influencing matter. You'd have to agree with me that your body is made up of a vast array of atoms and molecules, and that these atoms and molecules form chemicals. Those chemicals organize into cells, which form tissues, that further organize into organs, which create various systems within your body. For example, a muscle cell is made of different chemicals, proteins, ions, cytokines, growth factors, which are made up of the different interactions of molecules, which are made up of various atomic bonds. Those atoms share an invisible field of information to form molecules. The chemicals that make up a cell also share a field of information. It's that invisible field of information that orchestrates the hundreds of thousands of functions of the cell at any given second. scientists are beginning to realize that a field of information exists that's responsible for myriad cellular functions, existing beyond the boundaries of matter. It's this invisible field of consciousness that orchestrates all of the functions of the cells, tissues, organs, and systems of the body. How do certain chemicals and molecules of your cells know what to do and interact with such precision? There's an energetic field surrounding the cell that's the summation of energy from atoms, molecules, and chemicals working together in balance that gives birth to matter, and it's that vital field of information that matter draws from. For instance, the muscle cells in the previous example can further organize and specialize into tissues called muscle tissue. Let's say that the particular type of muscle tissue in this example is called cardiac muscle. Cardiac muscle tissue forms an organ called the heart. The tissues, which are made of cells, share a field of information that allows the heart to function in a coherent manner. The heart is part of the cardiovascular system of the entire body. As it shares this field of information, it organizes matter to function in a harmonic, holistic way. So the field that's created that gives birth to matter is what controls matter. The greater the field, the faster the atoms vibrate, or the faster your subatomic fan blades spin. The Newtonian model of biology is based on linear events in which chemical reactions occur in a sequence of steps. But that's not actually how biology works. You can no longer explain something even as simple as how a cut heals without the understanding of the interconnected, coherent information pathways you just read about. Cells share an intercommunication of information in a non-linear way. The universe and all the biological systems within it share an integration of independent, entangled energy fields that, in turn, share information beyond space and time on a moment-to-moment basis. Research confirms that most interactions between cells happen faster than the speed of light. And since the limit of this physical reality is the speed of light, that means that cells must communicate by the quantum field. The interactions between atoms and molecules form an intercommunication that unifies the physical, material world and the energy fields that make up the whole. In the quantum, the linear, predictable characteristics of the Newtonian world do not exist. Things interact in a holistic, cooperative manner. So according to the quantum model of reality, we could say that all disease is a lowering of frequency. Think about stress hormones. When your nervous system is under the control of fight or flight mode, the chemicals of survival cause you to be more matter and less energy. You become a materialist because you're defining reality with your senses. You overuse the vital energy surrounding the cell by mobilizing it for an emergency. And all of your attention goes towards the outer world of the environment, the body and time. If you keep the stress response turned on for extended periods of time, the long-term effects keep slowing down the frequency of the body such that it becomes more and more particle and less wave. That means there's less consciousness, energy, and information available for atoms, molecules, and chemicals to share. As a result, you become matter trying futilely to change matter. You are a body trying without success to change a body. All of the individual subatomic fans making up your body start spinning not only slower, but also out of rhythm with one another. This creates incoherence among the body's atoms and molecules, which causes a weakened signal of communication, such that the body begins to break down. The more your body is matter, and the less it is energy, the more you're at the mercy of the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, where material things in the universe tend to move toward disorder and breakdown. Think what would happen if you had hundreds of fans in one enormous room, all working together and spinning in harmony, humming away in unison. That coherent humming would be like music to your ears, because it would be rhythmic and consistent. That's what it's like in our bodies when the signals between our atoms, molecules, and cells are strong and coherent. Now imagine how different it would be if there weren't enough electricity, energy, getting to each of the fans, resulting in their spinning at different speeds or frequencies. The room would then be filled with a cacophony of incoherent clanking, wobbling, stopping and starting. That's what it's like when the signals between our body's atoms, molecules, and cells are weaker and incoherent. When you change your energy because you made a decision with firm intention, you increase the frequency of your atomic structure and create a more intentional, coherent electromagnetic signature, as depicted in Figure 8.4. You're now affecting the physical matter of your body. By increasing your energy, you increase the electricity flowing to your atomic fans. The elevated frequency begins to entrain or to organize the cells of your body to become less particle, matter, and more wave, energy. Or to put it another way, all of your matter has more energy or more information. Think of coherence as rhythm or orderliness, and incoherence as the lack of rhythm, lack of orderliness, and lack of synchrony. Imagine a group of 100 drummers with no rhythm banging on drums all at the same time. That's incoherence. Now imagine that a group of 5 professional drummers shows up among the mob of wannabe drummers, spreads out to different locations in the crowd, and starts to create a very rhythmic beat. In time, the 5 would entrain the entire 100 other drummers into perfect rhythm, orderliness, and synchrony. That's exactly what happens when your body responds to a new mind, when the hair on the back of your neck stands up, because you feel more like energy and less like matter. In that moment, you're lifting matter to a new mind. You're entraining the disease that exists as a lowering of frequency to an elevated frequency. At the same time, you're also causing the incoherent information that existed among the atoms and molecules, chemicals and cells, tissues and organs, and systems of the body to instead function from a field of more organized information. It's like hearing static on your radio, and then tuning into a clear signal where all of a sudden the static disappears, and you can hear the music. Your brain and nervous system do the same by tuning in to higher, more coherent frequencies. Once that occurs, you're no longer subject to the law of entropy. You experience reverse entropy, and the coherent signature of the energy field around your body causes you to be immune to the typical laws of physical reality. Now all of the atomic fans are spinning at a faster, coherent frequency, and the physical molecules, chemicals, and cells that make up your body are receiving new information so that your energy is having a positive effect on your body. Figures 8.5A, 8.5B, and 8.5C on the following page illustrate how a higher, more coherent frequency of energy entrains a slower, more incoherent frequency of matter, lifting matter to a new mind. The more organized and coherent your energy, the more you entrain matter at an organized frequency, and the faster that frequency, the better and the more profound the electromagnetic signal the cell receives. Remember, as you learned in the previous chapter, cells are 100 times more sensitive to electromagnetic signals, energy, than to chemical signals, and it's these signals that change DNA expression. The more incoherent and unsynchronized your energy is, on the other hand, the less able your cells are to communicate with one another. You'll learn the science of how to create coherence very shortly. Since the quantum field is an invisible field of information, its frequency beyond space and time that all things material come from, and is made of consciousness and energy, then everything physical in the universe is unified within and connected to this field. And since all things material are made of atoms, which are connected beyond space and time, then you and I, along with all things in the universe, are connected by this field of intelligence. Personal and universal, both within us and all around us, that gives life, information, energy, and consciousness to all things. Call it what you will, but this is the universal intelligence that's giving you life right now. It organizes and orchestrates the hundreds of thousands of notes in the harmonious symphony that is your physiology, those things that are a part of your autonomic nervous system. This intelligence keeps your heart beating more than 101,000 times a day to pump more than 2 gallons of blood per minute, traveling more than 60,000 miles in each 24-hour period. As you finish reading this sentence, your body will have made 25 trillion cells, and each of the 70 trillion cells that make up your body executes somewhere between 100,000 to 6 trillion functions per second. You'll inhale 2 million liters of oxygen today, and each time you inhale, that oxygen will be distributed to every cell in your body within seconds. Do you consciously keep track of all that? Or does something that has a mind so much greater than your mind, and a will so much greater than your will, do it for you? That's love. In fact, that intelligence loves you so much that it loves you into life. It's the same universal mind that animates every aspect of the material universe. This invisible field of intelligence exists beyond space and time, and it's where all things material come from. It causes supernovas to be born in distant galaxies, and roses to bloom in Versailles. It keeps the planets revolving around our sun, and the tides rising and falling at Malibu. Because it exists in all places and at all times, and is both within you and all around you, this intelligence must be both personal and universal. So there's a subjective, free will consciousness, the individual awareness called you, and there's an objective consciousness, the universal awareness, that's responsible for all life. If you were to close your eyes and take your attention off your body and all of the people, things, and events arising at different times and places in your external environment, letting go of time for a moment, you, as the quantum observer, would be removing your energy from your familiar life and investing your awareness into the unknown field of possibilities. Since where you place your attention is where you place your energy, then if you keep placing your awareness on your known life, your energy is invested in that familiar life. But if you were to invest your energy in the unknown field of possibilities beyond space and time, and you instead became a consciousness, a thought in quantum potential, you'd be drawing a new experience to yourself. As you enter a meditative state, your subjective, free will consciousness would merge with the objective, universal consciousness, and you'd be planting a seed in possibility. The self-organizing, autonomic nervous system is your connection to that innate intelligence I mentioned that performs all of those automatic functions for you. It's certainly not your thinking neocortex that's responsible for the functions mentioned previously. Instead, it's the lower brain centers below the neocortex that subconsciously run the show. This loving intelligence is what you merge with in meditation when you lay down the ego and go from selfish to selfless, when you become pure consciousness, no longer a body in the environment or in linear time, but instead, no body, no one, no thing.